John 19. We've been through the story. The garden, the anguish, the prayer, the disciples sleeping, the betrayal, the flattening of the mob, Malchus' ear being healed, the arrest, Jesus being led away, John and Peter following, the hearing before Annas where Jesus is slapped, the midnight test trial before Caiaphas where they try to find a way to make it appear that they've got a legal case against Jesus. Peter melting down loudly outside the courtroom, denying Jesus. The mocking by the Jews until dawn. The quick dawn trial to appear to be a legal trial after sunrise before the Sanhedrin, where Judas interrupts with his remorseful cries. Then off to Pilate, the accusation, the interview about the kingdom and the truth. Pilate says, not guilty. Sends him to Herod. Herod wants to be entertained with miracles. Jesus refuses, says not a word. Jesus gets dressed in a sparkling robe and sent back to Pilate after being mocked. Pilate offers a deal. I'll cut a deal with you. I got this really bad guy named Barabbas. I'm either going to let him free or your king. Which do you want? And he was hoping they'd go for Jesus and he'd get off the hook, but they cried for Barabbas. Pilate's wife sends him a message. I've had a dream about this. Don't get involved in this. Pilate says, I find him not guilty, but I'll, remember, learn him and release him. The Bible usually says chastise, but it's just the word to be learned, to learn. I'm using bad English here, to learn somebody, okay, to educate somebody. I'll teach him a lesson, which is probably referring to scourging, and release him. So I'll make sure he is so impressed that he doesn't want to do whatever he was doing you didn't like again. They said, no, we want his death. Pilate washes his hands, says, I find no fault in him. Then he has Jesus scourged, the Roman whipping, which is literally whipping someone right until they're almost dead, but not quite. Then the Roman soldiers dress him in purple, the color of royalty. They put a crown on his head. And they have a great time showing very clear what they think of the Jews and anyone among the Jews who claims to be a king. Pilate comes out. Behold the man. He introduces Jesus. I want you to know, I find him not guilty. You take him and crucify him, because I don't find any problem here. Oh, they said, we have a law. He claims to be the Son of God. Therefore, he deserves to die. It's blasphemy. Pilate is spooked. He brings Jesus back in. Who are you? Jesus doesn't speak. Don't you know that I have power to crucify you or release you? Jesus says the only power you have is any power that's given you from above. Therefore, the greater sin is those out there. Yours may be the sin of weakness, but theirs is the sin of malice. Pilate, it says, from that time on, sought to release Jesus. But he is the victim of his own political machine. If you don't convict this guy who claims to be a king, Caesar will get you. Pilate knows. It's either do the right thing or lose his life or his job or his wealth. So he comes out once again. Now, instead of behold the man, he introduces Jesus as behold your king. Jesus again appears, purple, crown of thorns. And the Jews do something they couldn't imagine before or after that they did. They said, we have no king but Caesar. We're nothing but good Romans now. Pilate basically rubbed their nose in it and then gave in. It says he sent Jesus. Verse 16, delivered him to them to be crucified. So they took Jesus and led him away. And he, bearing his cross, went out to a place called the Place of the Skull, which in Hebrew is Golgotha. Now, if you get out the little half sheet in tiny type, put on your glasses so you can read it. John has Jesus, verse 17, bearing his cross to the place of the skull. The place of the skull. The Greek word is simply cranium. Its emphasis is a little different. It's cranion. Cranion almost sounds like cranion. But it's our word that we get cranium. It's only used four places in the New Testament, and that is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, referring to where Jesus was crucified. It's used two places in the Old Testament. I don't know how many of you remember the story of Abimelech, but he was a rebel who went around killing all the leaders in Israel for a while and almost managed to get all the power to himself until he was attacking a tower that had a group of people in it, and he was going to kill them all unless they proclaimed him king. And it says a lady who was hiding in the tower looked out a window, saw him at the base, and dropped a millstone on his head. His head, his kephale, that's the word for head, and it crushed his cranium, okay? That's the word. So it's not the word for head, it's the word for the skull, the bony matter evidently, or at least the top of the head. And one other place, the only other place in the Septuagint that it's referred to is, you remember Jezebel? I think it was Jehu rode into town, and Jezebel was up in a window painting her eyes, and he said to her servants, throw her down. So they tossed her out the window, and he went on in to have dinner. I don't understand some of these stories. Throw her down, and he went in and had dinner. And when he came, when they were done with dinner, he said, go bury her. And they went out, and all they found was the cranium, her feet, and the palms of her hand. The dogs had taken care of the rest by then. So they didn't even find the head. All they found was the what was left after the dogs had chewed on the head. The word cranium. It's very interesting. I was looking in the four different Gospels. In fact, this is the New King James Version on here. You'll notice Matthew, verse 33, they came to the place called Golgotha, which is to say place of the skull. Golgotha is Aramaic, from the Hebrew Gulgulet, which was the cranium of Jezebel in Hebrew. Mark says also they came to the place called Golgotha, which is translated place of the skull. Place of the skull is simply the word cranion. Luke, verse 33, when they had come to the place called Calvary. I thought, well, that's interesting. How come Luke uses the word Calvary and the others use the word place of the skull? So I looked it up in the Greek, and it's still cranion. I have not a clue why they choose in Luke to do a totally different word, because it's just literally cranion. They came to the place called the skull, or the cranium. And then you also have it in John. So it's really the same word all the way across for place of the skull. Calvary is just simply the skull. There's... You can be the first on your block to discuss that with your neighbors. They'll be excited. But I had to check it out. Now, John simply has Jesus bearing his cross to Calvary, or the place of the skull, Golgotha, where they crucified him and two others with him, one on either side and Jesus in the center. But you'll notice Matthew, Mark, and Luke all give us a little different piece of the story. So working from the harmony, notice it says they led him away to be crucified. John says he came out bearing his own cross. But then the other three Gospels says as they came out, they found a man, they compelled a man, they laid hold of a certain man named Simon, and he was from Cyrene. Now Cyrene is basically a city in the area of what is now Libya, so North Africa. We know that there was a major Jewish colony there which means we don't automatically say that Simon was a black man. He could have been just the Jew who'd been transplanted to that area of the world. There was also we found in archaeologically that there was a synagogue in Jerusalem. Now, a synagogue just means a gathering place. S-Y-N, sin is together. Soon, more in our language. Okay? A synagogue was where the agog, the agora, the meeting place, the public place for the people to get together. Okay? So a synagogue was just we call it a church now, but a gathering place, an assembly hall, that had a religious Jewish connotation. And there was a synagogue in Jerusalem for the Cyrenians. I don't know quite how it works. They had their own church. Maybe they came over for church. That'd be a long trip. But however it worked, there evidently was a large colony and some had immigrated back to Jerusalem. So Simon may have been black in skin, or he may have just been a Middle Eastern Jew who'd been transplanted in one of the dispersions over to the area of Libya, and for some reason, whether temporarily or permanently, was back in Jerusalem. We don't know if he was a Cyrenian who had come to live in Jerusalem or if he was a Cyrenian coming to visit for Passover. But the one interesting thing we do discover is that Mark says, the father of Alexander and Rufus. Now, the best we can tell, and we can't prove any of this, but John Mark, who seems to have written the Gospel of Mark, became a faithful aide to Simon Peter late in Simon Peter's life. And the best we have from the ancient records, and which how accurate they are, sometimes we aren't sure, but the best we have is it appears that John Mark was probably, he probably wrote his gospel under the influence of Peter. Many suggest that Mark is Peter's gospel. Mark's the scribe. You know, Luke wasn't an eyewitness. Luke never did see Jesus. He traveled with Paul. He was a physician. But he said, I gathered up the stories. Okay? Mark's is the most condensed. Matthew seems to build on Mark, and Luke seems to build on the both of them. So we often think Mark was probably the first gospel written, and it's Peter telling the story to Mark, who is the scribe. Who, whether it's John Mark, who appears to have been a young teenage boy who hung out with the disciples because his mother was one of those women who traveled and supported Jesus, John tells the story, or John Mark tells the story here, and maybe it's Peter, but notice he says, and they compelled a certain man, Simon of a Cyrenian, the father of Alexander and Rufus. Well, who in the world are Alexander and Rufus, all right? I remember I was my freshman year in academy in high school, I was the boys' club chaplain. I think it's a job where I've never done less. But anyway, I was the boys' club chaplain. And I think I went to one boys' club leader's meeting. And we were sitting there talking about some things. And one of the other guys that was president or vice president or whatever, he was trying to explain who somebody was. Do you know so-and-so? You know, do you know George? You know, the guy with the blonde hair that, you know, rooms and so on. And we couldn't figure out who that was. And he says, well, do you know Peter so-and-so? And several people said, yeah, I know him. He said, well, they're not related. And we all had a good laugh. But if John Mark, through Peter here, says, you know, Simon the Cyrenian, the father of Alexander and Rufus, what do you assume from that? The people they were writing this gospel to would obviously know Alexander and Rufus. They weren't just, you know, two guys running a 7-Eleven, you know, in the backside of Rome. They evidently were people that would be known by the church. So something we gather from this, these are some of the little things that make the New Testament authentic, by the way. Is this just something that was concocted? Most concocted narratives are too carefully written to involve these kind of little offhanded tidbits. He's the father of Alexander and Rufus. Evidently, whatever happened to Simon as he carried the cross ended up with at least his sons being prominent members of the Christian movement in the years to come. John Mark was probably written definitely before the destruction of Jerusalem. Peter, we believe, lost his life under the reign of Nero, Nero was the one in the burning of Rome, right? So we know that Peter died before the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. So this gospel was probably written somewhere around 65-ish, 60 to 65, we guess. And so, 30 years. 30 years after the cross, they're writing, hey, he's the father of Alexander and Rufus. You get the feeling these were guys that were known, as if you were to name public figures, at least prominent figures within the church. There is one little reference over in the book of Romans, chapter 16. Now, we have a bunch of Alexanders mentioned in Scripture, so we have absolutely no idea if any of those relate. They don't appear to. But in Acts chapter 16, I'm sorry, Romans chapter 16, I was leafing through Acts at the moment. Romans chapter 16, verse 13, and here in Romans 16, it's, greet Aquila and Priscilla, and verse 5, greet the church that meets in their house, verse 6, greet Mary, verse 7, greet Andronicus and Junia, and 8, greet Amplias, and they go on down, verse 13, and greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and his mother and mine. I don't think that means whoever wrote Romans, Paul, was a brother of Rufus. I think it was an endearing term. But clearly, the writer here knew Rufus and Rufus's mother and held them in very high esteem. Okay? Once again, a little more trivia. You can share that with your neighbors, Alexander and Rufus. But I just find it interesting. Obviously, whatever happened to Simon that day affected at least his boys. We don't hear any more about Simon. 30 years later, they were prominent members of the Christian movement enough that Peter or Mark mentioned them as if everybody will know. Just like, you remember James and John, right? Remember Peter and Andrew? Well, there's Alexander and Rufus. All right, moving on. In the Gospel of Mark, he, Simon the Cyrenian, was coming out of the country and passing by. Now, this is a real, as my grandpa would call it, a dirty shirt. Something happened, grandpa would say, that's a dirty shirt. Something you didn't like. You're just probably around 8:30 or so in the morning. You're either arriving at Jerusalem from some other place, or you took a walk out of town in the morning. You're out jogging, right? And you're coming back in, and you're just minding your own business. That's what I see that phrase. He's just passing by. He's a completely uninvolved person, and there's something else going on. And he has no intention of getting involved in whatever it is. But he's just passing by. And what happens? He literally gets grabbed by Roman soldiers. Matthew says they found a man. Mark says they compelled a man. Luke says they laid hold of a man. So he's just coming into town minding his own business, and we don't know how far Jesus got. We don't know how far it was from the judgment hall of Pilate to Golgotha, because we're not sure where Pilate's judgment hall was. The current Via Dolorosa, which is considered the way of the cross, assumes that Pilate's judgment hall was in the Tower of Antonia, which was at the corner of the temple complex. There's good evidence that that may not have been where Pilate's judgment hall was. It may have been the old palace of Herod the Great across town. We're not even totally sure where Golgotha was. There's a little cliffside that kind of looks like a skull that most people consider to be the place of the skull. What kind of changes in 2,000 years came to a cliffside, right? Whether it looked like that then, we don't know. So we really don't know where Jesus was crucified exactly, and we really don't know where Pilate's judgment hall was. But it was a bit of a walk. It was at least had to be probably a few hundred yards. It was from somewhere inside the city to somewhere outside the city. And by the way, that outside is probably now inside. You got that. During the Middle Ages, the city grew, and there's walls beyond where the walls were. So we don't really know. It's hard to build shrines. So there's shrines here and shrines there and shrines everywhere. Like Peter on the Mount of Transfiguration wanted to build shrines. We are into building shrines. We'd rather give a few bricks rather than give our lives, right? We devote some property rather than devoting our time. We seem to think somehow God is into relics. He's into relationship. But somewhere along the way, evidently, Jesus, loss of blood, Roman scourging just about drained you of blood, up all night, no food or water, probably for over 12 hours, simply gave out. You know, we hear he fell beneath the load. We almost think that phrase must be in the scriptures, but it's not. Everything we have in the scriptures is right here. John says he went out bearing his cross to the place called the cranium, place of the skull. Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell us that Simon bore the cross. So we fill in the gaps. Evidently, Jesus couldn't carry his cross because a crucifixion victim was supposed to carry their own cross. And evidently, about the time Jesus fell, this Simon guy was walking by. Maybe he showed some sympathy. I hope I would have. But for whatever reason, he just happens to be the innocent bystander that gets grabbed. And on him they laid the cross, that he might bear it after Jesus. If you were Simon, just coming in from your morning jog, and the police grab you and say, "Here, carry that," what would your reaction be? Oh, sure, happy to oblige. What would your reaction be? You don't have any right. That's where I'd go immediately, right? I do have some rights. You know, the police don't have any right to stop me and say, "Get out and carry this thing for the next 100 yards. No way, forget it. I mean, I think I'd be angry, wouldn't you? I'd be ticked, I'd be miffed, I'd feel used, abused. This isn't right. Back in those days, you didn't have any choice. The Roman soldier could simply put a spear through you if they wanted to, and there'd be no consequence. You were just a hated Jew who resisted the authority. And Simon is forced to carry the cross. His day has a very unpleasant interruption. I've even heard it suggested that Simon, being from Cyrene, which is North Africa, was black, and here you have another case of blacks being enslaved and abused, which could be the case. I haven't really studied. I don't really know the Roman relationship, you know, the Latin, white, off-white, you know, a little dark, Mediterranean complexion to blacks. I know the Romans had slaves of everybody. They didn't care what color you were. If they could, they'd enslave you. And there were so many Roman slaves that they outnumbered the citizens by so many, by multiples, that they had to be ruthless on their slaves, because if slaves ever revolted, the non-slaves, the owners, would be outnumbered. The free men would be outnumbered. It would be a massacre. And so that they ruthlessly held their slaves. And here, Simon, who's not a Roman slave, is being treated like one. How dare you? How do we handle the interruptions in life? How do you handle interruptions? Take the interruption of somebody at the stoplight who's texting when the light turns green, and it takes them 5 seconds to hit the gas. How do you handle that little interruption? You know, drive, right? Let's go. We're pretty impatient with 5 second, 2 second interruptions. What do you do in something major? Have you had something major interrupt your life? Like a car wreck? You got backed into or driven into the other day. Somebody drove into the back quarter panel of his car and disabled it. Has your life been interrupted by a divorce? By a disease? By an accident? Anybody here not had their life interrupted? But how do we handle it? How do we handle the little interruptions? You think about it. You get up and your day is full. You've got appointments every minute for the day and things you need to do. And you know that today you've got to be efficient. And what happens? You have a flat tire. Somebody runs into your car. Somebody needs help. My favorite one is Friday afternoon. You know, every Friday I have to get ready for finals. You understand what I mean? When I get up here on Sabbath morning, hopefully I'm not going to make a complete fool of myself. I need to have something to say. So sometimes I say I'm cramming for finals. And that's invariably when somebody in need knocks on the door of the church, and it's something that's going to take a lot of time. You know, I don't spend Friday afternoons at the church very often because I don't want to be interrupted. I've read a few authors who suggested, from a ministerial perspective, that they've learned that it's the interruptions in their day that are often the times when they truly do ministry. And have challenged themselves and their readers to look at interruptions as very possibly divine appointments where God is saying, yeah, you may have this, 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 and this to do, but I have something else for you to do. And we grumble, and we groan, and we moan, and we get angry, and we get impatient. But it's very possible that the interruption of your day could be from the Lord. Now think about Simon's interruption. He has to carry a rough wooden cross that's heavy on his shoulder. Probably left a bruise and some splinters. Behind a man, we don't know whether he had a clue who Jesus was or not. Who's been beaten nearly to death and is now being forced to walk up a hill. He's too weak to carry this thing and you're having to carry it for him. As far as you know, he may be just like the guy in front and the guy behind who are hardened criminals, the other two. But you're forced to carry this guy's cross. You're forced into the circumstance. You're forced into the moment. You're forced to walk along asking the question, who is this guy? Why is he taking this the way he is? Why isn't he cursing and swearing like the other two? Why does he turn to the women on the way? Luke gives us this little piece. A great multitude of people followed Jesus, and women who also mourned and lamented him. Ah, the Pharisees did not manage to have a quiet little crucifixion before anybody knew what was going on. The thing got pulled into the day far enough that there ends up crowds on the street. Women lamenting and mourning. Have you heard Middle Eastern women lament and mourn? It's a loud affair. But Jesus, turning to them, said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children." Now, do you think those other two that were crucified with Jesus would have looked around and said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, don't weep for me, weep for you, you and your children"? No, they'd be cursing, angry. There's a different spirit here, and Simon sees it. He hears it. Jesus is tender and kind to the women along the way who are mourning for him. "For indeed the days are coming in which they will say, 'Blessed are the barren, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things in the green wood, what will they do in the dry?" What's Jesus saying? He's saying, you folks need to be concerned about what's ahead for the rest of you. Because if this is how people act in the greenwood, now think about greenwood. Greenwood is where the sap is flowing. Things are working. It's healthy. It's springy. It's vibrant. What's it going to be like when all of that's dried up and everything's just dry? It's as if he's saying, if this is how people act, how people treat other people, when the economy's normal, you have homes and food to eat, and things seem to be going along fairly normally for the times, how do you think they're going to start treating each other when they're out of food, out of housing, out of everything, under siege, in war, and things are stressful? I mean, if this is how we act when things are pretty normal, what's going to happen when the supermarket shelves are bare? Do you see what Jesus is saying? When times are normal like now, and people treat each other with such inhumanity, what's it going to be like when there's scarcity and want? People will kill and murder for a glass of water. I mean, we could get onto all kinds of side topics here. Yeah, you're going to save up all that food and water for the time of trouble? Yeah, well, somebody will just come and kill you to get it. Right? But Jesus, he's speaking here in compassion. Simon hears in the man who's beaten nearly to death, who's stumbling ahead of him, trying to crawl up the hill to his own painful murder, and he's trying to console the people, not curse them. Simon has to see this. He carries the cross. You get the feeling that he probably watched to see what in the world would happen. As he lays the cross down and they slam Jesus down onto it and begin driving big spikes through his wrists and feet. And he's saying, "Father, forgive them." Simon is pulled into this. And you get the feeling that Simon became a believer in Jesus because of what he saw. Just like the centurion when Jesus died said, "Surely this was a righteous man. Surely this was the Son of God." And he ends up with his sons 30 years later when Simon is probably now dead and gone as well-known men, evidently leaders in the church, such that Peter, John Mark would say, "You know, Alexander and Rufus, it was their dad. That's the one that carried the cross." An interruption that probably interrupted Simon's life and changed it forever. Interruptions. Have any of you experienced an interruption in your life that ended up changing your life for the better? And now you look back and realize, if I hadn't been interrupted there, where would I be now? It might have been an illness. It might have been the end of a relationship or even a divorce. It might have been an accident that left you in pain. It might have been the loss of a dream. Young lady is going to be baptized second service. Her name is Leah. She's the girlfriend of Kyle. Kyle preaches here once in a while. Kyle Steensma. She went through college, got great grades, dreaming of going to medical school. Never got in. Turned down. I was visiting with her earlier this week. She said, I spent about a year just kind of figuring, what do I do? I just kind of wandered, worked at Starbucks, and just kind of, she had dreams of medical school and they were dashed. But during that year, she came to realize that really wasn't what she wanted to do with her life. And then Kyle went to Starbucks, and it's history from there. And because of meeting Kyle, today she's being baptized. The kingdom of heaven instead of medical school. Which is better? God knows what he's doing in our lives. And yes, poo-poo occurs. Bad things happen to righteous people. Saints get cancer, not just sinners. But our lives are still under the overall umbrella of God. And his love is still there. Such that I believe Romans 8:28 is still in the book. All things do in the long run. You may be in pain or very unhappy with God in the short run. But all things in the long run, we will see God work for good in those who love him and are called according to his purpose. It doesn't say everything turns out for good. It says things will turn out for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. If we put our lives in his hands, some incredibly unhappy, unexciting, and painful things may happen that initially make you want to scream, make you angry, make you cry out, God, where in the world are you? I mean, if I were Simon, I'd be wondering, God, how can you allow this kind of stuff to happen? But he met Jesus. And his sons met Jesus. God will interrupt your life for one of two reasons. And when you have an interruption that's more than 5 seconds at a stoplight turning green, when you have a real interruption, remember the story of Simon. God is doing one of two things. He's either giving you an opportunity to minister that you would have missed. It's a divine appointment to go and be his hands and feet to somebody else. He takes you out of your daytime or an appointment book and he puts you in his and says, I need you to do this right now. When those kind of things happen, God, is this an opportunity you have brought for me to serve and represent you? The other reason God will interrupt your life is if you're headed, picking up steam the wrong way. Remember our deep phrase, you will end up where you're headed? I've used that the last 2 weeks. If God knows where you're headed and sees where it ends, if you had a child that was running happily down through a field and didn't know there was a cliff on the other side, and you tripped them and they fell and broke their arm, have you done a loving deed? Yes, you have. You saved their life. Interruptions are either to give us an opportunity to serve or their God allowing either his action or Satan's evil action or random action to bring a halt, at least temporarily, to the direction you were headed. And you can be like Pharaoh. He kept coming to a halt and getting up and going the same direction harder. It called hardening his heart. Or you can get up and kind of shake yourself over what happened and say, well, now where should I go? God, are you trying to say something to me? More than one person will be in the kingdom of God because God tripped them up, even if it hurt when they fell. Just passing by. Don't be surprised when you're just passing by, going on with your life, things happen. Try looking up and asking God, are you in this? Yeah, sometimes it's just the garbage of this world, folks. But even then, if we trust God, he knows what he's doing. He'll walk us through it. He'll bring us out stronger on the other side, deeper trusting in him than we would be without it. No, he doesn't want it to happen. I get so sick of people saying, oh, it must have been God's will. Somebody gets an illness and dies. Some child is abused. Something happens. Oh, God's sovereign. Must have been God's will. No, it wasn't God's will. But if we trust him with our lives, he'll use whatever it is to shove it back in the devil's face so that if it hadn't happened in the first place, or how do I want to put this? God makes sure that everything the devil does to try to take you out, if you respond to it in the Lord, it'll take the devil out. Just like Pilate ended up rubbing the Jews' nose in it. In a way, when we respond to whatever interrupts with trust in God, we get to rub the devil's nose in it. Because God will turn it for more good than if he hadn't have done it in the first place. But it all depends. It's coming out for good depends on whether we face it in trust. Have we given our lives, interruptions or not, to the Lord? Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Jesus, we have a hard time with interruptions. And we have a habit of facing them with impatience, anger, discouragement, blaming you or others. Would you remind us of Simon next time we face one of these interruptions? Just bring this story to our mind. That sometimes bearing a cross may be our own road to salvation. You may be in this thing, at least to use it for good if we trust you. And by trusting you, even if it's from the devil, we can bring you into it. And know that the outcome will end up for good. So we want to say thank you for your interruptions. Now, though we didn't say thank you then. And may we learn to face life in you, whether it's normal or interrupted, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.